Again to the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, April 5th, 2013. This is podcast number 296, and my name is Ben Stone. Real quick announcement, as I have been doing lately, Porkfest 10 will be June 17th through 23rd at the Rogers Campground, Lancaster, New Hampshire. This is the 2013 Porkfest. And I can't do anything more than encourage you. If you've never been to a pork fest, you don't know what you're missing. It is the height of the year. It is the absolute pinnacle of the liberty movement every year. And if you can at all, I want to encourage you to get out there. You ought to get your reservations done pretty quickly, because that place is filling up very rapidly, if there's any spots left at all. If you can't get into Rogers Campground, there are other campgrounds and motels and so forth in the region, but I would really encourage you to do whatever you need to do within reason to get to Porkfest 10, because it's going to be a lot of fun. And I rarely speak about the future in absolute terms, because nobody knows what the future is going to be like. But there are some things that are so predictable that you don't have to be Nostradamus to know that the sun's going to rise tomorrow and certain things are going to happen. And I'm telling you, as long as the sun shines and the grass is green and Porkfest happens, it's going to be a hoot. So if you can, get out there. Also, Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo is going to be April 27th. That's a Saturday. It's going to be in Exeter, New Hampshire at the Exeter Town Hall. And I can't make it to that, but I would encourage anybody who can to get out there, have a lot of fun. You don't need to call ahead of time. There's no reservations. There's no cost. Just get out there to Exeter and have some fun. Also, the first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, hosted by the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition, will take place at Brighton Recreation Area in Brighton, Michigan. If you can get out there at all, my wife Cindy and I are certainly planning on making it. This is going to be a long weekend of peace, liberty, and family-friendly camping in the heart of the summer, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, August 17th, 18th, and 19th. Registration is open, and if I can remember to do it, there'll be a link in today's show notes for the registration page over at the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition's website. And also, if you have an event that you'd like for me to give an announcement for, just give me the details and put that in an email. Send it to badquaker@badquaker.com. And I have done these announcements for these organizations just as a courtesy. None of them are paying for it. So if you have some kind of event like that, drop me a line. And if it's a legitimate liberty event, I will definitely give you a free shout out and give you free advertisement for it. Now, speaking of advertising and free and money and things like that, the time has come for the BadQuaker.com podcast to have its PBS moment. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, we have donate buttons on the website and so forth like that, and sometimes we have advertisers that actually pay us money. Most of our advertisers do not pay us money. Most of our advertising we do because we support the cause that they're supporting. But there does come a time every year when the bills and the donations are not matching each other, and so we need to bring this up. Now, yesterday I had I want you to think about the resources that are available at badquaker.com and what we've done for you, not just me, but the whole staff here, what we've done for you, the listener, over the years that there's been a badquaker.com. And I'm saying this because as of last month, as of March of 2013, badquaker.com is officially 2 years old. So to give you an idea of just of the interviews that we've been able to bring you here at BadQuaker.com. Of course, yesterday was the interview with Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. We talked about drugs and greenbackers and bitcoins. And I wanted to let you know that I had talked on Facebook and I had talked on the podcast that we're going to have a Bitcoin guy that's going to come on and talk to us about Bitcoins, and we're gathering questions for him and stuff. Well, that wasn't Mark Thornton. Mark Thornton's with the Mises Institute, and I wanted to get his opinion on Bitcoins because I respect his opinion as an economist. But we're still hoping and planning to get a guy specifically on Bitcoins to answer those questions. So if you didn't hear your question ask, it wasn't because I didn't follow through with it. It's because we haven't got the Bitcoin guy on yet, but we will. And even if the first guy that we have lined up, if he falls through, we'll get somebody else. But that's our definite plan, is to get a Bitcoin person on and ask those questions that we've been saving up for him. But now consider, back to our PBS moment here. Consider the different people that we've brought interviews with. We had Mark Thornton. The other day we had Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute. Scott Horton was on with us. Michael Humer, professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado, also a speaker at Porkfest. We had him on. Will Coley, my friend from Muslims for Liberty. Will Coley was a great guest. We had him on. Davi Baker, the Muslim agorist. Nima Vedati from the Freedom Fiends, and of course we had Michael W. Dean from the Freedom Fiends on several occasions. We've had Kevin McKernan, the DNA scientist, that's going through and doing the genome on the medical marijuana issues. We had the legendary Dave Ridley from the Ridley Report, a member of the Free State Project. Derek J. Freeman from Live Free or Dance, filmmaker. You probably know him from Derek J.'s Victimless Crime Spree, the movie. Max Abramson, self-defense advocate. He was arrested for defending his own home from a dangerous felon. I believe we had Max on twice, if I recall. Ademo Freeman, the founder of Cop Block and a veteran of Motorhome Diaries. We had David Gordon on. I love talking to David Gordon. He is just such a brilliant guy. He's a philosopher, historian, fellow, a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. If you recall, we had Dave McElroy, also a filmmaker, and what he called himself a recovering political prostitute. He was a lot of fun to talk to. James Bovard, author, activist, articles that appear regularly in the Wall Street Journal. Doug French was on the show. We had Doug French, senior editor of Laissez-Faire Books, also former president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. We had other people like Taryn Lupo, Larkin Rose, Mike Shanklin, Bill Anderson, Jake Shannon, the most interesting man in the Liberty Movement. We had Becky Akers. We've had Jeffrey Tucker on three different times. Economist Bob Murphy, author Glenn Tate, Kevin Goodsman has been on with us, Bill Buepert. We had three different interviews with Bill Buepert, and Bill Buepert is just amazing to talk to. Just his mind is just, he's fascinating. George Donnelly, we had George on the interview with us. Of course, Stefan Molyneux, Bob Higgs. Now, keep in mind also, I want to give you a little bit of a teaser. In the works, we've got, like I said, the possible Bitcoin, one way or the other, we'll have somebody on about Bitcoins. Somebody who sells them, somebody who knows a lot about them. So we're going to get those questions answered on Bitcoins. We're also working on getting the guy who, his uncle was very likely killed by the CIA over the Watergate thing. And his cousin was the inspiration for the Val Kilmer movie Thunderheart. Gary North, we might be able to get Gary North on this month. He asked me to get back in touch with him sometime this month and see if he's waiting for a very special announcement. And he wants to have that ready whenever he comes on the podcast. So there's a good likelihood that we're going to have Gary North on this month. Mark Edge. Now, if you recall, back before the 2012 election, Mark Edge and I had attempted to, we were gonna have a debate on voting, and there was a series of things that went wrong, and that didn't take place. But it's definitely something that you know, Mark and I have talked about it, and we definitely want to cover this. So I'm thinking that we'll probably, sometime before the next election cycle in November, and I realize that's a minor, 2013 is a minor election cycle, but, you know, probably sometime before November of 2013, I'll probably try to arrange something with Mark Edge so that we can have that debate on voting. If you recall, we had historian Hunt Tooley on back in December, and we definitely want to have Hunt back on again. I need to contact Hunt and find out how it'll fit on his schedule, but he was very interested in coming back on the show, and I'd love to have him back on. Radley Balco, are you familiar with Radley Balco's work? He is a really, really a good author. And we're hoping to have him on either in August or July. He has a new book coming out. So hopefully we can be in on the interviews that he does around that time to introduce his new book. Hans Hermann Hoppe, he's going to be at Porkfest this year. And I'm going to make every effort to try to corner him and get an interview out of him. I don't know how successful I'll be at that. And if you're going to be at Porkfest, if you can have any influence on Hans Hermann Hoppe to let me interview him, boy, be sure and do that. That's how we landed, Boston Tea Party last year, and Stefan Molyneux, the Bad Quaker listeners at Porkfest, just tormented Stefan Molyneux until finally I was able to catch him and I said, "Hey, Stefan," and he's like, I know, I'll do it." Because so many of our listeners had just pushed him and pushed him. So, you know, if we could do that with Hans Hermann Hoppe, politely, very politely, and the guys were polite with Stefan, but just if we can politely do that with Hans Hermann Hoppe as well, then I'm sure he'd be happy to do a interview with us. You know, I was going to interview Stefan Kinsella back when we were camping and moving around throughout the South, and the technical difficulties just blew that interview away, and I haven't been able to work out the time frames correctly to get him back on the show, but I definitely am going to try to get Stefan Kinsella on to talk about IP and IP laws and copyrights and everything like that. So these things are all in the works, and they're coming, all in their own time and everything. And the purpose of me saying all that was to try to emphasize that not just BadQuaker.com is not just, a podcast. We're doing everything we can to bring you interviews with some of the main people in the movement. We're doing everything we can to keep up with the, you know, whatever current is going on, like with Bitcoins right now. And in addition to that, like I mentioned before, you know, we're just past the 2 years of Bad Quaker podcast. BadQuaker.com was established with less than $400 of startup, and that was in March of 2011, and we had 38 listeners. Now I know this because I can pretty much name those 38 listeners. So in March of 2011, we started up with 38 listeners. Now, by March of 2012, BadQuaker.com was showing 1.4 terabytes of downloads for the month of March 2012. We were also showing over 4,500 unique visitors that month. So in the 1 year, we had gone from 38 listeners and, you know, very little downloads, because there wasn't a whole lot there to download. It was just, a very small little group of faithful listeners. And with the first year from March of 2011 to March 2012, we were putting out 1.4 terabytes of downloads, of people downloading the podcast. Now, last month made the second year, and we've had steady growth since that March of 2011. We've had steady growth with BadQuaker.com, and last month we had 7.2 terabytes of downloads. We had around 10,000 unique visitors to BadQuaker.com website, and I might mention that's just Bad Quaker badquaker.com visitors. That's not, you see, in addition to the stuff that's available at badquaker.com, the podcast is also rebroadcast by people like Podcast Deutschland, Stitcher. You know, you can find it on iTunes. It's rebroadcast on Liberty Radio Network. And there are others as well. And so people are getting the podcast without actually visiting the badquaker.com website. So we don't really know how many people are listening. We know that there's a lot, and we know that it's growing steadily. We know, for instance, that, you know, there was an email that we tracked in China that caused over 1,000 downloads of a single podcast in one day. This one email went viral in China, and in one day, over 1,000 downloads of the same podcast happened in that one day. And so, you know, things like this can happen on the internet really quickly, and something happens and something just takes off. Now, the issue, the reason I'm bringing all this up is that, of course, all this costs money. And our budget, and keep in mind now, there's no salary for me. I've never taken a salary from badquaker.com, and I never will take a salary from badquaker.com. Everything I do for badquaker.com is on a strictly voluntary basis. I don't own anything to do with it. I am simply a contributor like other contributors. We have, you know, like, for example, Bob Higgs contributed an article. We were the exclusive publisher of that article back last, no, let's see, that may have been 2011. No, it was last year in 2012. And we were the exclusive publisher of that article. And Bob Higgs, as a contributor, didn't get paid for that. He just did it because, you know, out of friendship with me and out of support for the podcast. So none of the contributors at badquaker.com are paid. Personally, I've never been paid to speak anywhere that I've gone to and talked. I've never been paid for that. And I've never been offered to go and be paid to speak anywhere. It's just never come up as part of the question. So, and our staff here, no one on the staff has ever taken a salary from badquaker.com. And that includes our mods and administrators at the forum as well. It's all voluntary to support this mission. So far, and just in a spirit of openness and again, in the PBS fashion, so far, since its inception in 2011, badquaker.com has cost a little over $7,000. It's cost roughly $7,000 to bring badquaker.com to you. And during that time, badquaker.com has brought in roughly $3,700 in donations and advertising. And so so we got 7,000 going out, 3,700 coming back in. Now, in addition to this, not long ago, my wife Cindy left her career of 14 years in a major legal information company to come on board badquaker.com as management and to take care of the details and start to make this a wider distributed and, you know, better formats and everything like that. So we're doing literally everything we can to try to make this mission a successful operation. And so what do we have planned for the future? Well, we have set up a fund to take Cindy and myself to Porkfest 10 in 2013. Currently, we have about a third of the money required to get Cindy and I there. It's our plan that if we exceed that amount in donations or in whatever, in any way, if we exceed that amount that it's going to take to get Cindy and I there, we're going to use the extra money to help staff members Kai, Hannah, and Matt get to Porkfest. Currently, we plan on attending the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest in August that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, but at this point, we have nothing in the fund to go towards that. So again, that's just in essence, it's an act of faith that the money is going to come in for us to do these things. And I did also want to let you know, as we're going through this PBS type money discussion, that currently badquaker.com website is paid for and secure for another year. So it's our intention to keep this going, and we have no intention of shutting it down. And I want to thank everyone who has contributed. And I want to let you know that, you know, we've had some pretty good-sized donations, and we really appreciate those. And we've also had some donations that were just what people could afford, and we appreciate those as well. Now, just to give you a little bit more information on badquaker.com, you might ask yourself, well, who's listening to the podcast? Well, we do have some statistics on that, and I'm going to not actually give you numbers because that would be boring. But I can tell you that the vast majority of our listeners are in the U.S. Coming in, this is our top 10 countries of listenership. The U.S. is number one, Canada is number two, and Great Britain is number three. And that's fairly obvious. You know, I speak English, so you would think that it would go in that order. Number four place is Germany, number five is China, number six is Australia, number seven is Hong Kong, number eight is New Zealand, number nine is Sweden, number 10 is Norway, and number 11 is Denmark. Now, this is kind of interesting because all those Germany through Denmark, number four spot through number 11, are almost tied with each other in the number of listeners in each of those countries. And that's pretty amazing because if you think about, first off, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark are kind of huddled together up there. They don't have all that huge of a population. Germany, on the other hand, is the figures are distorted slightly from Germany because the way the internet system counts, Germany is able to get credit for some hits that are not necessarily in Germany. So there might be, without going into that too much. So if we lump Scandinavia together and we lump Germany, sort of consider Germany as a larger region rather than an individual country, then we have far more listeners in Scandinavia. It would be almost comparable to Canada. So anyway, I don't know if that's interesting or not, but that's our listenership. That's where they're located. And I was really amazed that we have that many listeners in China and in Hong Kong. Again, if you put the China numbers together with the Hong Kong numbers, we're getting up there close to the listenership of Great Britain or Canada. Now, of course, you hear me, if you listen to the podcast regularly, you hear me in the little commercials talking about Amazon. And Amazon is a real steady form of income for us. And I really want to thank the folks that shop at Amazon from the Bad Quaker link. It really helps. It's a nice steady income. It's not huge or anything like that. But every month when we see the deposit from Amazon, my wife and I just get all excited. Look, it's $60 this month. It's $50 this month. It's really exciting to us. I want to tell you some of the interesting things that were purchased in last month in March through the Bad Quaker affiliate program with Amazon. For example, a Dodge Ram 1500 or 2000 or 2500 pickup grill. Somebody ordered parts for, or perhaps a whole grill for, a pickup truck through Amazon. You know, it's been said, I think Lou Rockwell said, that you can get almost anything at Amazon.com. But I think it was Michael Dean that corrected Lou Rockwell and said, you can get anything at Amazon.com except guns and weed. But you can get the movie Guns and Weed at Amazon.com. So, yeah, you really can. I mean, you can buy a grill for a pickup at Amazon.com, and that's pretty crazy. And if you do it through our link, it helps Bad Quaker. Now, in books, I was very happy to see that in the month of March, several books that are really important to me were purchased through Amazon by our supporters. Conceived in Liberty, Economics in One Lesson, The Ethics of Liberty, and others as well. It's really thrilling to see, you know, I talk about these books and then people actually order them on Amazon through our link. And it's really thrilling. In computers, in the computer category through the Amazon link, someone ordered a component repair opening pry tool set. Now, keep in mind with these things, we can see that the item has been purchased through our account, but we can't see who purchased it or any details of any individual buyers. So it just tells us the item and how much, you know, what kind of cut we get for that. So I don't know what it was, but I think for the for this repair tool, I think we got something like I can't remember, 20 cents or something like that. Not the point though. All these things add together and it's just thrilling. Someone else ordered a wireless 8-point router. A router for a computer, not a router that one might use in woodworking. A black mouse pad. Someone ordered a black mouse pad through Amazon. Isn't that cool? And right next to that in the list is a 15.6-inch Core i3 320 gigabyte notebook computer. Someone ordered a whole notebook computer through Amazon. Through our link at Amazon, we were thrilled to see that because we Amazon pays us for that. So thanks whoever ordered that notebook. Thanks, man. That's great. USB 3.0 hub with cable and power adapter. In the DVDs collection, someone ordered Cancer: The Forbidden Cures, and that made me think. You know what? I'd like to watch that. I'd like to see that. In the electronics. And I'm not going to list everything. This is just stuff that struck my mind as like, hey, that's neat. Anything you can think of is at Amazon. Kindle eBooks, The Undefeated Mind. Under musical instruments, somebody ordered a Behringer USB Premium 24-input mixer with mic preamps and compressors. I don't know for a fact, but I got a pretty good idea who ordered that one. Somebody ordered a jerry can, a 5-gallon military-style jerry can. Cool. I'd like to have one of those. So that's what that's our primary support is Amazon.com. And to see these things purchased each time at Amazon is just thrilling for us. And we really appreciate the support that folks are clicking on that link. And I want to encourage you, if you have never had an account at Amazon.com, you think maybe it's not your kind of a thing or it's very complicated or whatever, it's super simple to set up. If you plan your purchase ahead of time, you can end up getting free shipping. I think they're going to change it pretty soon, but in most cases you can get you can buy your purchases tax free without sales tax, and it's just super convenient to shop at Amazon. So to all the people who have done that, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, and we're going to continue. In 2013 to try to do everything that we can do at badquaker.com to provide you the ongoing podcasts that we've been doing. Thanks very much, folks. Stick with me through the break. When I get back, there's not going to be any more begging, I promise. I'm going to talk about Mark Thornton a little bit in his Iron Law of Prohibition. And then I want to talk about the war on drugs and the war in Afghanistan and the CIA and maybe a little bit about Ronald Reagan. So stick with me through the commercial. The real part of the podcast is still to come. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. And so I wanted to talk about Mark Thornton. The last podcast, when I had Mark Thornton on, we had touched on the Iron Law of Prohibition. And I'm not sure, well, you know, we did cover it pretty good. But I'm not sure that you can really cover that topic in such a short period of time. Basically, what we're talking about with the Iron Law of Prohibition is that the harder that a government cracks down on something, and this can be for either outlawing it entirely, or maybe just taxing it really heavily, or regulating it very, very heavily, or whatever. Whatever the government is doing that creates an alternative market for that item, or for that product, or whatever, service, whatever. What you tend to do is you tend to distort the purity of that product. You drive the price up. You distort the whole market in such a way that you actually, the heavier you attempt to enforce the government oppression on that market, the worse the effect is going to be. And so we talked specifically about alcohol and alcohol prohibition. And we talked a little bit about the drug prohibition and how it produces the exact opposite result of what the do-gooders that think that a prohibition against something like this can do. But it's wider than that. You know, I mentioned just in passing and talking to Mark, I mentioned brandy. And, you know, brandy, the development of brandy happened because there was increasing amounts of taxation on imports of wine. And I believe this is in the Netherlands, if memory serves me correctly. And so the wine importers, rather than paying the really high taxation on wine, they decided to start distilling the wine down. And that's how brandy came about. Brandy is basically, literally means burned wine. Brandy wine meant burned wine. So they would concentrate the wine into a higher alcohol content so that it was more like a liquor. And then they would import it, and it would be taxed the same because the tax was by the barrel. So they were able to tax it, import it at that tax rate, and then mix water back with it to revitalize it until they figured out that they actually preferred it in the more concentrated levels. So it was literally, it was the high taxation that caused the product to go from being simply wine, which runs like 10-12% alcohol, to brandy, which is running maybe 40-50% alcohol at the time. So you actually created a far more dangerous product just by this taxation. And you can see that in all kinds of different settings, whether we're talking about drugs or alcohol, prostitution. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. The attempts, the do-gooder attempts at regulating or at taxation or at stopping something, prohibiting it altogether, always produce negative results, far worse than the original deviant activity, if you want to look at it that way, it was producing. So now, in reference to that, and in keeping with sort of the theme of the stupidity of the drug war, I want to read something from the website stopthedrugwar.org. And the reason I'm reading it is just really kind of to get us rolling on the topic a little bit. Unfortunately, it appears to me that they have a bit of a statist view here, you know, hoping that the government, sure, the government has messed this situation up. If only the government would come riding to our aid on a white horse and save us from the evil government stupidity. Only government can help us from the government. That kind of nonsense. Anyway, the title of this article, and this is from just a couple of days ago, the title is "Afghan Opium Cultivation Rising," officials say. And it says, "Illicit opium production cultivation in Afghanistan is on the increase this year," the Afghan Ministry of Counter-Narcotics said Monday. The increase comes despite efforts to target traffickers and to provide alternative development opportunities for farmers. Opium is the raw material from which heroin and other narcotics are derived. Opium production has been a mainstay of the economy in the war-ravaged country ever since the U.S. and NATO forces invaded in October 2001. Prior to the invasion, the Taliban had allowed poppy growing up until 2000, when a ban dramatically lowered the production. Actually, it lowered it to almost zero. In 2001, there was almost no exports of opium from Afghanistan. That's me talking, not the article. Let's go back to the article. But production took off again after the invasion. Really? But production took off again after the invasion, and for the past decade, Afghanistan has accounted for the bulk, for the vast bulk of global opium production, producing as much as 90% of the total world supply. Efforts to suppress opium production have been half-hearted and ineffective, in part because doing so threatens the drive threatens to drive the poppy-producing peasants into the hands of the Taliban, and in part because Afghan officials are themselves implicated in the trade. Okay, back to the article. This guy, I'm not going to try to attempt to say his name, who is the ministry spokesman, told Radio Free Europe on Monday that 157,000 hectares are being planted with poppies this spring. That's 2013. 157,000 hectares are being planted with poppies this spring. That's up an estimated 3,000 hectares over last year. Hectares. Anyway, this guy says that the rise in production could be blamed on the lack of security. Really? The lack of security? And widespread poverty. People plant stuff because they're starving to death and they're poor. So they plant, really, man, that's brilliant. I wonder how much that guy got paid to figure that out. He says that the Karzai government and the ministry have set up special task forces to eradicate opium plantings in four southern and southeastern provinces. Those provinces are also areas where the Taliban is strong. So in other words, Karzai is setting up this task force. We all know how effective government task forces are at eradicating, drug trafficking. But so Karzai is setting up this task force, and it's going after the areas where the Taliban is strong. But nowhere in the article does it say anything about Karzai's connections to the poppy production, to the opium trade in other parts of Afghanistan, that he's looking the other way, or that he's having NATO or even private military forces protecting his opium production. Today, if you go to today's show notes, I'm going to put a picture of a friend of mine and take a look at it. He's a good guy, but he's a friend of mine, and he's a professional soldier, and by that I don't mean he is U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, anything like that. He is a professional soldier. He is hired in the market to be a soldier, and when you look at the picture of him, you'll see that he's in the middle of a poppy field, because there's a lot of that. There's a lot of high-level professional soldiers that are hired from around the world, and they guard the Afghan poppy fields on behalf of both American and Afghan officials. And so what I'm saying here is that that 90% of the production of poppies in the world is right there in Afghanistan, and it's being protected by not only American troops, NATO troops, and by private military that's mostly being paid for. Ultimately, it is being paid for by American taxpayers. That's who's ultimately paying for those private security companies that protect the opium production. Now, you might say, well, that's kind of a wild accusation. Do you have some kind of proof to back that up? You have some kind of evidence that all that's going on? Well, first off, take a look at that picture. And I have direct conversations with the individual in that picture on a regular basis. I know who's paying him. I know where the money comes from. I know what he does for a living. And so, I have direct evidence. I have direct testimony. But in addition to that, there's nothing unusual about this. This is business as usual. This is how the CIA has operated in Afghanistan for a very long time. And the fact that in 2000, the Taliban, who was the controlling political group in Afghanistan at the time, the Taliban decided that it was immoral for the country to be growing all this poppy, all these poppies, and it was immoral to be turning this into opium. So they outlawed it, and they almost completely stopped opium production in Afghanistan in 2000. The 2001 market showed the effect of that, since, you know, if you stop growing something, you still have the current growing season, so it's a year delay in the process before the numbers actually come through for the harvest. So that in 2001, the Afghanistan opium market was almost zero. And this put the CIA into a position of panic, because they had been making a lot of money off the Afghanistan opium production right up to that point. So you say, okay, well, that's the accusation. How are you going to support that? Think back with me for a moment to the 1980s. October 14th, 1982 was when Ronald Reagan declared drugs to be a threat to U.S. national security. And technically, the war on drugs started with Nixon, but when Reagan did that, it really put the so-called drug war into a new position. It funneled massive amounts of federal money into a variety of law enforcement agencies and police departments and everything else in order to begin really kicking up the prohibition against drugs. So then how does that make any sense in light of this accusation that the CIA is involved in the drug trafficking? Well, before we get into that, think back about that time. Think about Nancy Reagan and how she'd gather a bunch of kids on the White House lawn, and they're all wearing T-shirts that say, "Just say no," and it's just a great photo op. There's Nancy, and there's all these people there, and everybody, all the kids are being indoctrinated into their Just Say No program. Right in that time frame, like I said, D.C. starts dumping massive amounts of your tax money into this war on drugs. Well, what does that do? Well, think about the iron law that we were just talking about. What does it do when you dump a bunch of money into the enforcement of a prohibition? It makes the product far more profitable. It makes it more profitable to concentrate the product, and it makes it more profitable to drive production offshore. So I was talking with Mark Thornton specifically about meth and the crackdown on meth, and the crackdown specifically on the mom and pop operations who were who were mixing small batches here and there around the United States, and they were difficult to catch because they would go in and they would make a small batch and then they would distribute it, and then most of these people were addicts, so they wouldn't make any more for maybe a few weeks until they ran out themselves. Well, all that, there was this huge crackdown on that, and the result was that since so many meth producers were getting busted in the U.S., it became more profitable for drug cartels, specifically in Central America, to begin, and in Mexico, to begin producing higher quality, higher concentrations of meth offshore, and then importing it into the U.S. So the meth, the potency of the meth went up dramatically, which increased the addiction rates, because all of a sudden if people were used to it being at a certain level and all of a sudden it's a dramatically higher concentration of meth, then instantly it's easier to become addicted to it, and it's far more damaging to the individuals that are taking it. And of course, no crackdown is going to stop it. If there's a market demand for something, the market will always overcome efforts to stop that market demand. So it didn't matter how much money the government dumped into the process. As long as there's a market demand for it, then all you're doing is making it more dangerous, more expensive, not just expensive, more profitable on the selling end, more profitable, and forcing it to be concentrated into a more deadly form. So now, back to Reagan. Well, Reagan people, Reagan's actual people in the White House, without going into all the things with Ollie North and all that kind of stuff. Well, the actual Reagan people were running the old drugs for cash for arms swap between Iran and Central America. The CIA, and I'm going to get into the documentation on this in a minute, the CIA was dumping cheap heroin into the Soviet Union through Afghanistan. And this is early 80s we're talking about, but it was also happening prior to that. But in the early 80s, the CIA was dumping cheap heroin into the Soviet Union through Afghanistan, through Pakistan. The whole time the CIA was militarizing fringe Muslim groups with radical propaganda, all this material being printed in the U.S., and this radical hate school is being set up all over the Middle East run by the CIA, and this radical hate material being printed in the U.S. and distributed by the CIA. So the CIA was literally indoctrinating little children throughout the Middle East to become radicals, and those radicals are now adults, and they're literally shooting at American troops right in the same region. Now, if you think about it, at the same time that the Reagan administration was attempting to brainwash American children about drugs, lying to them about the effects of drugs, lying to them about what drugs were, what they did to you, and so forth like this, with their DARE programs and Just Say No and this nonsensical programs like that. The same time that the Reagan administration was trying to indoctrinate American children, the CIA was indoctrinating children in the Middle East to hate America. At the same exact time, the same government, two different branches. It could be argued one wasn't attached to the other, but it was still taking place. Now, I want you to think about something. If you go and you ask 100 high school students, why does history suck? Why do you hate history class? Why are you not doing well in history? The answer you're going to get back is going to be basically that history is complicated, it's boring, and it's meaningless. When taught by a school, now I realize I probably have some history buffs who are listening. And for people like me, I love history. Ever since I was a little kid, I just dug into history all that I could. But for your average student in a government school, history is boring, complicated, and meaningless. They can't apply it in their own life in any way. Now, here's an interesting thing. Do you remember back when they were having the Benghazi hearings, when there was, the talk was, will Hillary have to testify, or Hillary did testify, here's what she said, and the media was making a big hype about it. But at the same time, pretty much everybody I know felt that the coverage of the Benghazi hearings was complicated, boring, and meaningless. Now, isn't that a weird coincidence that schools teach history in a way that is complicated, boring, and meaningless, and the mainstream media gives very important coverage on current events that are shaping history, and they do so in a way that is boring, complicated, and meaningless? Because you see, the mainstream media is exactly like government schools. It's basically two different tentacles of the same beast. Media does the exact same things that school does. They overemphasize every minute detail that means absolutely nothing. And they teach you nothing about it. They don't tell you why these details have any importance. They don't bring it home to your life so that you can relate to it. And they do this until you're so bored that you stop paying attention. And then all of a sudden it's Shark Week, or it's Team Spirit Week, or whatever. There's something exciting that pulls your mind away from it. What? Lindsay Lohan is what? What? What's the deal? Oh, I don't know. Let's go look at that. Forget about American soldiers being murdered by the CIA. Forget about that. Forget about CIA soldiers being murdered by the CIA. Don't think about it. Just don't even think about it. Don't think about American generals getting ready to swoop in and help those soldiers and being ordered to stand down and let them die. Don't think about that. Don't think about any of those aspects of it. Only listen to the mainstream media and be bored by their dry accounting or their constant bickering and arguing with the two talking heads that are really not saying anything at all while they're getting more and more angry with each other and not providing you with any real information. That's what the media is doing for you. Well, schools do pretty much the same thing in a different way with the way they teach history. So now, I have notes that I'm working on for a future podcast, and so I wanted to steal just a little bit out of them and kind of give you an idea of what's going on with Afghanistan. In the late 70s, there was a lot of stuff going on in Afghanistan. There was a lot of interference by the U.S. in Afghanistan, and there was a lot of interference by the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And during that time frame, the American people had no idea anything was going on. By the early 80s, the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, and there was an outcry. Why didn't we know this was going to happen? How come the CIA didn't notify of this? Where was the intelligence community? How come we didn't know that the Soviet Union had been preparing for this for years? How do we not know? And the CIA kind of got a little bit of a black eye. It was kind of inferred by the State Department and by the Reagan administration. Well, we didn't know. We didn't know they were going to do that. That came out of nowhere. Well, that's a lie. And there's a report that was put together by a guy named Douglas, and I'm going to mess up his name probably, Douglas McCutcheon. He was, for a while, he was the deputy director for intelligence at the CIA. And he wrote a report titled Predicting the Soviet Invasion of Afghanistan, the Intelligence Community's Record. And in that report, he attempted to set the record straight that not only did the CIA know, but the CIA regularly kept Nixon informed in those years. He kept the intelligence community kept Ford informed during his years as president. The intelligence community kept Jimmy Carter informed, and when Ronald Reagan took the presidency, the intelligence community kept him informed as well. The point of the report is that it is not our fault. If anybody didn't know that the Soviet Union was getting ready to invade Russia, it's not Afghanistan. It was not the CIA's fault, and so that was the purpose of this report. But if you get into it and start reading it, I've talked about this report before. It's written just like every other government document. It's like swimming through Jell-O. It's just thick and stupid and backwards and not written in any kind of a timeline, and not, you know, it's really, really hard to get through it because of the way that it's these people are not, you know, you don't have a deputy director for intelligence at the CIA in that position because he's good at presentations. Let's put it that way. Okay, so anyway, so this guy, his name is Douglas McCutcheon. He had a 32-year career at the CIA. Just coincidentally, he was a key 9/11 Commission staff member. He made an interest, just on a side note, in the book The Black Banners, former FBI agent Ali Sofan says that this same Douglas McCutcheon believed that the CIA deliberately withheld information from the FBI in January 2001 when the CIA knew that there had been a gathering in Kuala Lumpur in 2000 that the CIA had monitored and knew about. And the information that they had gathered there, they knew about the, and this was in connection to the 2000 USS Cole bombing, the ship that Al-Qaeda bombed in 2000, in the year 2000. The CIA knew that two of the future Flight 77 hijackers were a part of that and connected with that. And through this meeting in Malaysia, this in Kuala Lumpur, the CIA had information connecting the hijackers that if they would have shared it with the FBI, the CIA knew they were in America at the time, and if the CIA would have shared that with the FBI in their investigation on the USS Cole, then it's possible that the FBI actually would have picked them up and arrested them for their involvements in the USS Cole prior to them flying the airplane, flying Flight 77 into buildings in 9/11. Just kind of think about that for a minute. This is not a 9/11 conspiracy thing. It's just, why didn't the CIA, if the CIA knew that two terrorists involved in the Cole bombing, in the USS Cole bombing, were in the U.S. and available to be picked up, why didn't they say anything? I mean, it's like, why wouldn't you? So, using McCutcheon's words in his report predicting the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, I'm working on this timeline of events that goes from 1955 to the present day that shows foreign interference in Afghanistan, both British, U.S., and Soviet, and French, actually, and Pakistani. Well, and Iranian. All the interference in the Afghan government over the years that have provided us the mess that we have, including a 1976 thing called Operation Mosquito. It was developed in 76. It wasn't really put into place until a little bit later, sometime probably around 78. The CIA, under their Operation Mosquito, began utilizing a Pakistani bank, the BCCI, and I'll get into that at some point in time. But they began, the CIA began, and this was, I might say, this was an operation that was headed by George Herbert Walker Bush, Papa Bush, the older Papa Bush. And so it was used in the drug connections in Pakistan to flood Soviet Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan with cheap heroin and cheap cocaine, causing the addiction rates to skyrocket in the Soviet military, in those Soviet military bases in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. Now, this was happening starting in 78 and was actually cited as one of the reasons for the Soviet invasion. Just one, but one of the reasons for the Soviet invasion into Afghanistan was to try to stop this flow of opium and cocaine into the Soviet Union. So literally, it was the Soviet Union's war on drugs, one of the driving factors that pushed them into Afghanistan. In reference to the BCCI, this bank, 1991 Time magazine described the bank like this, and this is a quote I'm going to read out of their article. They called it a global intelligence operation and mafia-like enforcement squad, operating primarily out of the bank's offices in Karachi, Pakistan. They have a 1,500 employee black network that has sophisticated spy equipment and techniques, along with bribery, extortion, kidnapping, and even in some accounts, murder. The black network, so called by its own members, stops at almost nothing to further the bank's aim around the world. And then a final point on that. According to investigative journalist Joseph Trento in his 2005 book Prelude to Terror, the Saudi intelligence minister was given the task back, this is we're talking back in 76 when this Operation Mosquito was first started, by George H.W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Papa Bush, who was then head of the CIA, to transform what was then a small Pakistani merchant bank. It's called Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, into a worldwide money laundering machine for the CIA, buying banks around the world to create the biggest clandestine money network in history. Papa Bush himself had an account at BCCI, and that's while he was a director of the CIA. While investigating the international heroin trade, French custom agents raided the Paris BCCI branch and discovered accounts in Bush's name, establishing a public record of the connection. So this is not just wide-eyed accusations. This stuff is documented. It's scattered around a little bit, but it's in information released by the CIA, information that's public records due to like this raid in Paris of the bank. So I'm going to have to wrap it up there and not really finish off and tell how Reagan was involved in this and how this, I've talked before about, oddly enough, 69 days into his presidency and Reagan is almost killed. Well, before that happened, Ronald Reagan acted to shut down Operation Mosquito, and he was told that it actually was shut down, but the fact is that it just kept rolling. And then after he was shot, then he reignited the whole system again. So now one last thing from our from the PBS announcements from earlier, from the money begging and so forth. Keep this in mind, that this is literally hours of research that has been done on this kind of stuff. And I'm gonna play off of today's podcast and go into more on Ronald Reagan and a little bit of a recap from podcast 200, where I talked about the Rockwell and later the Boeing B-1 bomber and information on that and the B-2 bomber and how that all wraps around Ronald Reagan being almost assassinated. So, come back again and listen to the podcast. We probably won't be begging again for another year or so. So you should be safe in hearing the next podcast. And remember, get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks, for listening today. Goodbye.